Welcome to the Watchers of the Skies program. I'm Carlos Campo, your president here at Ashland University and Theological Seminary, joined as always by my friend and colleague, Dennis Montecruces. Hello, Dennis.
How are you?
I'm great. We're here in the studio with talented students like Matt and Eli, Ireland, Bryn, and Michaela running the show. But it's not just any day. Here, after a three-year run, the Watchers are watching no longer. It's our final day of broadcasting. And today, I earlier had the opportunity to quiz you a bit on philosophy and why students should study philosophy. Thought you made some salient points about the fact that in some ways, it was the mother of all subjects in some ways. There was a time when particularly religiously affiliated, maybe even Catholic schools had five or six requirements. They've been watered down a bit. But you talked about how it forms the basis for logic, for critical thinking skills. And in a world where jobs are changing all the time, it really gives students a strong foundation for study and learning.
And for understanding the world.
Sure.
Yes.
Sure. Not an unimportant thing. We've often gone back and forth on my use of the word lens, right? What lens through which do you see the world? And while you don't love that construct much, however you frame your world and from your perspective, it formulates your philosophy. And you would suggest that your philosophy is a living thing?
Yes. Well, but I wouldn't say it's a lens. I mean, the lens... Well, depending on how you interpret lens, right?
Right?
So if you assume that it means that you're not getting to the world as it is, I would disagree. So,
right.
Yeah, so that's an important thing, that I think we are in touch with reality, and it's the direction of knowledge is from the world to us, not us imposing our grid on the world.
Sure, right. And I think, this idea of how do we help students see the world more mm-hmm. clearly, right? That much I think we would definitely agree on. I think it's the most noble thing that we can do, right? Am I seeing this clearly? Am I seeing the relationship between science and reason clearly? Am I seeing my own relationship with myself and people around mm-hmm. me? Am I seeing this clearly? We talk about rose-colored glasses, which is already a judgment, right? So there's a judgment inherent in saying you wear them. From our perspective, we want those glasses to be of the most transparent nature of all, right? So mm-hmm. you're seeing the world as clearly as possible. So we started with philosophy, and unfortunately now I've got to be grilled around my own discipline of English. And so have at it, Dennis. I'm ready to be grilled around why study English, what difference does it make?
Well, I mean, I'm actually curious about
sure.
not just why study it
okay.
in the academic sense,
yes.
but I'm really curious also about why, let's say, why study it in terms of just one's life, right? Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I was trying to say with philosophy is that it's a great discipline, or it's good to know something about philosophy, even if it's not your major, it's still worth studying, even for someone who's not in an academic context. Mm-hmm. So maybe say the same thing where, let's start off by saying, why is it a good major? Why is it useful as a major? But more than that, let's assume that you received absolutely no monetary benefit from English, which may be the case for many English majors anyway, just kidding. But even if there was no remuneration involved at all, why should all of us be readers, not necessarily of English only, but of literature?
Sure. Well, thanks for the question. And I think you point out something that's really important, so I'll just pause and call it out. There was a time, Dennis, where no one really talked about this ROI for an education in terms of financial remuneration. Everyone knew that the good life, truly to be educated, was part of the good life, and it had such intrinsic benefits, there was no need to even make that case.
Right.
So we'll go ahead and say that. And then, of course, I'm going to read from Sonnet number 55, which answers the question better than I can. I won't read the entire poem. Not marble, nor the gilded monuments of princes shall outlive this powerful rhyme, but you shall shine more bright in these contents than unswept stone besmeared with sluttish time. When wasteful war shall statues overturn and broils root out the work of masonry, nor Mars his sword, nor war's quick fire shall burn the living record of your memory. So when you...
Would you like to translate that for the audience?
Well, I think any translation would diminish the power of that language. And yes, that is the world's greatest writer in the English language, and maybe in any language, William Shakespeare, Sonnet number 55. And I would suggest that beauty is all you need to know, is one of the things that John Keats says. I don't know if I'd go as far as John Keats, but in his Ode to a Grecian Urn, that's one of the things that he points out, that this relationship between truth and beauty, mm-hmm. that there's an ineffable sense that every teacher must, in a sense, degrade. Even a philosophy teacher would have to degrade the power and the immutability that is inherent in great philosophy, because we both agree, Dennis, that there is something transcendent about life, right? Mm-hmm. That we are the creation of an eternal, unchanging, non-contingent being that we would call God. And as such, there is something that is expressed through art and literature and nature that should simply be stated on its own and allow it to just pour over the ears and lives of our students. So I would suggest it is the predominant reason why one would study, but you bring up these other incredibly important points, and that is someone who studies English, whether as a major or as a minor or simply part of their degree program, has to look closely, if they do it well, right? So you're reading closely, you're interpreting something closely. The critical thinking skills that a philosophy major and an English major would have very often go hand in hand. It generally requires a fair amount of writing. You and I both have a lot of admiration for a recent book that really looked at what students are doing today in the classroom and what they were doing 30 years ago. And one of the things that it pointed to is we're not requiring students to write or read nearly as much as we did. And there is indisputable evidence now that indicates that if students are pressed to write more and read more, they will learn better and it will be stickier than much of what they're writing now and so what they're doing now. So I would suggest that those are all reasons. You're a better communicator generally if you're studying English texts more closely. And I would suggest that in general, you want to challenge students, and great English texts do challenge students, and I think that's one of the things that will deepen their understanding. As you've pointed out in an earlier broadcast, you know, every discipline is connected. It's what we believed about the university, mm-hmm. right? That's why we call it. There's a unity to this area of study. You cannot study English effectively if you don't know the history of philosophy, if you don't know history in general. You know, people say, well, why did you have to learn language as a philosopher, as an English major, if you're studying it at the doctoral level? Well, for that very reason, because you understand that the history of language goes far beyond your ability to speak that language. It's about the migration of human beings and why they migrated, and what were the religious, the philosophical, and the other elements that led to their movement. And then what did they begin writing about? Right? Here's the frustration of any archaeologist, and that is that most of the stuff that we find has the most mundane things written upon it, right? They're right. Like receipts,
right?
You know, and even birth records, those kinds of things. The ability to think, even to have the time to think, where you're not just scratching out a living to have enough to drink or eat in a day. You know, most people would say the philosopher and the poet have something in common, and that is that they're not trying to just eke out a living, but they have enough sustenance that they can take this great plunge into the invention of our minds. So there, I guess, in a particularly poetic fashion, or at least flowery way, I've tried to answer your first question.
Well, okay. It was an interesting answer, and I would say, well, let me
sure.
step back. So many years ago, I actually took a couple of literature courses with you.
True.
And it was one of the best experiences I had in my undergraduate years.
Thank you. Thanks, Dennis.
So, I mean, it tells you how bad. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. The rest of your experience was.
No, they were really excellent classes, and I mean, I would say that for me, a lot of the value is that you can see. So in philosophy, typically you're going to discuss matters at a level of abstraction, mm-hmm. right? So ethics is, of course, critical to us as human beings, but you know, again, a philosopher is dealing with it in a kind of an argumentative way, in a systematic way. And what I take to be one of the tremendous aspects of literature is that you're entering into this sympathetically. So it's something that you in a way get to be a participant in.
Yes.
Right.
That's an excellent point.
So that strikes me as one of the great values of literature. So two things. So maybe say more about that. Mm-hmm. And secondly, to throw a little shade maybe on the discipline, and I'm not sure if it's still the same way, I suspect it is, but maybe you'll correct me, or maybe there's a backlash, that I've read lots of stories about people who have gone into English as not only a major, but let's say as a degree program, because they loved literature.
Yes.
And then they get into it, and it's like it's all this critical theory stuff. Mm-hmm. Even if you agree with the politics, right, it's just they're not studying literature. It's like, well, let's study the kind of theory about what's going on in this, and not really engaging with the piece itself and how it you know moves you as a human being.
Yes, so. Excellent. Well, let's see. I'll take that first question first. I remember a 17th century professor I had who was an expert in 17th century poetry, and he used to bring those corny little record players into the classroom that had the speaker attached to it, right? So he'd play records of Vincent Price reading these poems. And I'll never forget in class one day, we're listening to Vincent Price together, and about half the class is maybe listening, maybe two students are really engaged, most are not at all. But I looked up at him and he was weeping. Hmm. He was crying. And I thought to myself, what is it that moved him so deeply? And it brought to me this idea that there's more here, Carlos. Look more deeply at these words. And I think about a poem like In Memoriam by Tennyson. To me, it's maybe the greatest poem ever written in some ways. It took him about 30 years to complete it. It was upon the death of his friend Arthur Hallam that he wrote this poem. And I'll just remember one stanza or two from it, Dennis, and I should quote it. But you know, in essence, what it was about was he remembers standing in front of this man's house and knowing that he would never inhabit it again, nor would he inhabit his very life. And he actually was looking out at the day and almost questioning, how can another day even dawn without him? That it's as though life shouldn't continue, and yet it does. There was something almost brutal about that fact. And here he was on this bleak day, dumb, not being able to say anything more except that there was something almost crushing about this idea that another day is breaking as he stands in the rain before this man's house, knowing he will never come again. And I hadn't suffered the tragedy of loss that deeply when I first read that poem. And I think you know that I lost my mother at 17. Suddenly, she was there one day and gone. And that poem truly helped with some sort of catharsis, just reading through the struggle that Tennyson went through with the death of the person who had the greatest influence on his life, and reading those lines helped me in some ways that I can't even explain to deal with my own mother's death. And there's just one example of what I think right. you were hinting at. Mm-hmm. And truly, as scientists investigate, what is it? You know, what is it that when a curtain falls or a curtain is raised and we're brought into a scene and we connect in the way that you described? Same way, we're reading Once Upon a Time. And what is it? What is it about that brings us into the story where we will cry or we'll jump right. or, you know, all of those. And honestly, they don't know. They're not sure exactly how it is that we make that connection, but they certainly know that we do. And yes, I would suggest that every English teacher, as a matter of fact, it's one of the things I always used to do when I taught, and that's read from the text. Let mm-hmm. the text speak for itself. Because frankly, if you allow the words to speak for themselves, it's the most powerful blessing of all to me with the discipline. And I will say that you're onto something from my perspective in terms of how critical theory has bent and misshaped what the joy was in the study of literature. And I would just say turn to, you know, the London Review of Books or New York Review of Books and just look at the titles. Look at the titles over the last 5 years that have been published about Shakespeare. What are they about? They're not about historicity. Right. They're not about the language. They're not about the beauty. Not about this transition between early modern English and modern English. Instead, they're about things like queer theory and Shakespeare. Right. They, you know, they look into all of these. And I've had students say to me, I entered a doctoral program. I loved literature almost exactly the way that you put it. And this has just bashed my head in and I'm done with it. So I would agree that a return, and there are programs that have said we're committed to the text and it's where we're going and we're not, theory is important. It's an important construct to understand where we've been and where we're headed, but we're not going to let that dominate.
Yeah, no, and that's good. I mean, hopefully it catches on more. And I should say in philosophy, you have some of the same thing where unfortunately, I mean, it used to be let's look at the arguments,
right?
And instead, you have this. Well, okay, you know, here's a Marxist thing, here's a Heideggerian thing, and you know everything. But could we just look at the text and ask, is it true?
Right.
Yeah. So right. I mean, slightly different questions in English, but the same kind of thing where it's this kind of meta thing, as opposed to just getting to the thing itself.
Yes.
Absolutely. I kind of joked with you about this earlier, but you know, you said the greatest author in the English language, and maybe of all. But for many of us, reading Shakespeare or watching Shakespeare, especially when performed with authentic accents or what purports to be authentic accents, it's really frustrating. So, you know, here, this is fantastic, and we go, and what the heck is being said, you know, both between the language and the accents? So help us out here. You know, what do we do, those of us who aren't specialists? And
well, it's interesting because from my perspective, two things. One, I would say we go to the opera and don't understand a word, even if it's in English. We wouldn't understand a word of it. And yet there's beauty in the power of,
sure.
of the music. And I would say there's musicality in Shakespeare's language that doesn't need translation. But I also go back to the days of my youth where a Folger Shakespeare library in Washington, D.C. published these wonderful little texts that would have on one side of the page kind of translation of the more difficult words, and then the text itself on the other page. So what I was, and they also always preceded each scene with a summary of that scene.
Okay.
So I think that's a great way to read Shakespeare, even today. Read that contemporary English summary of the scene, and then you plunge into the Shakespeare itself, and then have a great, like an Arden's Shakespeare is one of the great published versions of Shakespeare. Have a great concordance, as it were, and there's so many online ones now that you can have that'll help you with the words. And one of the things I often will say is read the summary first and then read through it. Don't look at every word because it just breaks the meter and of the verse. You know, when you think that Shakespeare wrote this opening line, so here's the opening line to a famous Shakespearean play. Now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by this son of York. Great, incredible line. Now you think to yourself, now is the winter of our discontent. Those who are listening aren't seeing that I've just sounded out 10 syllables. 10 syllables. So not only are those lines striking, but they're 10-syllable lines, this iambic pentameter right. that follows all of, not all of what he writes, but in so much of what he writes. I mean, can you imagine that constraint, seeming constraint, whereas Wordsworth would say about that constraint, it's not that at all. That constraint, nuns fret not at their convent walls, right? Instead, they actually allow the spirit to flow through them in ways that they don't see it as a constraint at all. And Shakespeare didn't see it as a constraint. But when you think of the majesty of his genius. So I would say those things to those who are interested in Shakespeare. Hey, read a summary in contemporary English. Follow along after you've read through the scene. And then practice, you know, more of it. Watch contemporary versions of it. Watch different versions. You know, I am a purist when it comes to Shakespeare, but not to the extent that I'd say, oh, don't ever see a translation or don't watch a film version that cuts out all of these scenes. No, yeah, watch it all. Engage in all of it. I think there's something to be taken away from nearly all of it.
Nice. Yeah. So, I'm not sure. Shall I?
Just a couple minutes left. Yeah.
But so I hate to do the remuneration thing, but is it a good major? And also I would add, who are some contemporary writers who you think are just fantastic that we should all read?
Great. Well, I would say on the remuneration front, English majors do pretty well. One of the things you'll find is I still think it's the top major for law schools. So if you're thinking about going into the law, that's one of the things to consider is that it translates well from that perspective. Honestly, there are a fair amount of college presidents who were once English majors. And so this idea of having to read and write text carefully could lead to a future in higher education. That's one to think of as well. And in terms of contemporary writers, you know, I like some of Toni Morrison. I think that she's a terrific writer. I've been reading so much philosophy of late that I go back to that. And I couldn't end a show about English and not just talk about the power of Scripture. I just think we are so blessed to be able to read English texts of, you know, something written in Aramaic, Greek, and Hebrew that we're really blessed from that perspective as well. We're the watchers of the skies. And so thank you for joining us here on the program. We look forward to hearing from you. Write to us at president@ashland.edu. Until then, we wish you adieu here on the Watchers of the Skies program. See you next time.